Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Percussion Loft, the podcast from Gonbops, the leading percussion instrument manufacturer since 1954. I'm Rich Mangiacaro. So glad you could join us as we hear from the world's greatest drummers and percussionists. Let's get started. Hey everybody, welcome to the Percussion Loft. My guest today is Adam Topol, and we just heard Sueños Perdidos from his album Blue Painted Walls in Faraway Places on Brushfire Records. Hailing from Reno, Nevada, Adam is known for his many years working as the drummer and percussionist for the award-winning singer-songwriter Jack Johnson. His credits also include work with Ziggy Marley, David Gilmour, Jimmy Cliff, and many others. You originally came from Reno, and I'm just curious on how did this thing start for you as a young player? Did you do like everybody else, like all of us did, play in bands, or did you play in high school band? Did you start more streetwise or school wise, and how did it initially begin?
I think the real education, the real musical education happens. Mine anyway. I can't speak for anyone else's. I really. For most of my younger years, sort of rebelled against sort of academic or I guess institutional type musical training. And I regret it a little bit. You know, there was a symphonic band and a concert band, and they'd hand you a bass drum mallet or a xylophone or a snare drum part. And I was, you know, a little boy, like 11 or 12, I was listening to Kiss records. That was my interest, you know? And so just going whap on a bass drum and having a band director who wanted you to read a chart and be disciplined and be one among many. That's a tall order. And I really admire young kids that can fall in line like that. I was not that guy. I kind of did it, but it was a buzzkill for me. The happiest times I had either in grammar school or in high school were finding out about music through with my friends and just through adventures. You know, as more of a peer-to-peer sort of experiential sort of kid folklore things. You know, first it was up in Lake Tahoe, I guess what you would call now classic rock. I mean, Rich, remember hearing Boston for the first time, that band Boston, More Than a Feeling? You know, like, oh my God, it's like, you know, now, you know, things are different, but, you know, or in my case, I, you know, as a little guy, Kiss, you know, and then later on down the line, you get into the folk people like the Cat Stevens people. It's an experience when I had the opportunity to form my own bond with a song or with a record or with the sleeve of a record, where no one was telling me what to do necessarily. I didn't have to be there at 8:45. And be quiet and not play. It was my own freedom. And so I think that gave me the bug, you know, whereas in maybe band class, I don't know, man, I didn't connect with that, the formal education until much later. So Tahoe and Reno was like classic rock. Imagine parting your hair down the middle, you know, this was like Lake Tahoe 70s-ish and you know, and then I think the bigger education came along with this musical folkloric journey of my own. I went to a boarding school. It was a really nice place in Santa Barbara, and I was in the dormitories. And Lake Tahoe is a really small pool. You know, it's a good one, and there's some people are so sophisticated there in terms of their relationship with nature, and a lot of people from. The intermediate school I went to wound up going to Ivy League school. So this is in no way like disparaging towards that experience of growing up in Lake Tahoe. But I got tossed in the dorms in Southern California, in Santa Barbara, and there were kids all of a sudden like listening to the Specials, or, you know, the new wave thing or the punk thing was happening then. And all the, you know, people were starting to grab skateboards and they were surfing, and, you know, people were listening to classical music and people were listening to jazz music. And it was just a bunch of different kids from all over the world. And so that exposure happened. And, you know, again, band class was okay. The band leader was maybe wanting us to do like a Michael Jackson thing or a Weather Report thing. And that, although they're amazing too, that wasn't necessarily my wheelhouse. I kind of connected, but I kind of didn't. You know, school is a love-hate relationship with me, but having a band with my friends where you put together a presentation, you play some songs, you play at a school dance and people like it. You're just all of a sudden, you're behind this drum set and you're wailing on it and people love it and there's power there and you just get hooked, you know? And there's a bit of freedom. So that was the first bit.
You know, Adam, I was just wondering, when did you kind of realize that, oh, this is going to be lifelong? This is going to be, I have a feeling this is what I'm going to be wanting to do. Did you know that early on? Or did you know that kind of like as you were getting close to the end of your boarding school and kind of looking at maybe what you're going to do next, college or whatever?
Man, I'll be honest with you. I never made that choice. Like, I never looked at it like that. I don't think I could, you know. I just played with, you know, music has always been something that I've loved and I've wanted to be in my life. You know, from my early, one of my first memories is just going to up back in Lake Tahoe is just seeing a cover band set up on a lawn. And there was a drummer who just basically set up a drum set, built it, set like a contraption, just put it together and sat down and played it. And I just thought that was just the most magical thing. And I fell in love with it ever since. As far as like making a living or a career and all that stuff, I still, you know, I do it and stuff like that, but I still find it odd. You know, it's such a funny calling to call yourself like a professional musician or to use that as an identity, you know? But it certainly, music is like cemented in my heart. I will say that. So I think it's always been there as something that's been cemented in my heart. Absolutely. You know, some of the choices I've made certainly didn't reflect a person with ambitions to climb to the top of maybe a commercially musically successful person, you know? And of course, I deeply admire those focused people out there that have worked their way up. You know, I listen to a lot of podcasts and I hear people that are just incredibly motivated and have really, in a focused way, made it their calling and stuff like that. And I admire that. I've just taken such a circuitous route that's of course brought me to some incredible places, but I don't think it's conventionally, I don't view it as a conventional. I view it as an interesting adventure of twists and turns.
Yeah, so. I got you. Who were some of your early influences as a drummer and a percussionist? You don't have to go through a huge list, but I'm curious to hear who were some of the real early influences that kind of helped you mold what you do.
Okay. Well, fast forwarding, like, okay, so I got out of high school and I went to college in Los Angeles at USC. And I was like, just like this kind of, you know, curious sort of undergrad that was just trying to figure things out, you know? And I was interested. I did take an interest in jazz and music. And I had this cover band called the Wet Dogs. And there were two drummers. I was one of two drummers, you know, we just had a group of friends. And sometimes it just wasn't appropriate to have double drums, you know? I was good. I gravitated towards maybe sort of the pocket stuff and sort of the world reggae stuff. And the other drummer I was with, he goes by the name Irwin now, but back then he was Craig Levitz, was like, to this day, one of my favorite British classic rock drummers. So if something like the Zeppelin or Cream came on the books, he was playing drum kit. And so we went to professional drum shop. and we bought a set of congas, and they were gone box, my very first Marianos with the black bands. So I got into, I didn't know how to play them really. I didn't know what it was. I didn't, you know, you just kind of, you know, when you first play congas, you just sort of make do. So I took conga lessons with a guy named Roberto Miranda. He's still around. He was a faculty at USC. And so I just view this as this, I've lucked out into just bumping into some of the best educators in the world. Roberto had actually played with people like the great Horace Tapscott, who's now passed away, who's one of my favorite avant-garde jazz pianists. He played with Sonship Theus, who was a fixture. He played with Billy Higgins. He played with Charles Wright.
Right.
He'd even played with the great Arsenio Rodriguez, who was one of the progenitors of the amplified trace. And I didn't know any of those guys. And Roberto just was like a really like an uncle. And he showed me tumbao and wawanko and just showed me slap.
So he was your first real conga instructor?
He is, and he's still around. So that was the start, you know? And so just getting the basic technique on a conga, and it's really different. And you know, fast forwarding, if we're talking about that, you know, there was definitely a while where I was, you know, playing drum set, but and being in bands, but indie bands, you know, and it was more like, you know, I sold ties at one point. I taught special education at one point, but I was always in these indie bands and just playing around and doing stuff. And music was always a thing. And the percussion component came to the foreground. I went to Berklee College of Music and studied jazz. My principal was drum set, you know.
With Alan Dawson, was that right?
He had left, but I did study with him privately extensively. But I studied with John Ramsey, and I studied some really great people like Ian Frohman, Skip Haddon, like incredible people.
Mm-hmm.
But I later did study with Alan Dawson and went through the ritual and all that cool stuff. But, you know, one of my good friends, Ben Crames, was going back and forth to Cuba, and I didn't know, you know, didn't know much about it. You know, Cuban rhythms, I just assumed someone got behind a drum set and played really busy stuff with a cowbell, you know, and I'm more of a pocket player, so I'm not as busy. So I liked it, but I couldn't give it it didn't have a cultural reference to me. It just seemed like unfathomable and busy. And then I went and saw in Boston this group called Los Muñequitos de Matanzas.
Oh yeah.
And they they're from Cuba in an area called Matanzas, and they played mostly wawanko, which is a style of a rumba, you know, and where they were drumming. There were three congas up there, and there was somebody playing like a wawa, they call it, a piece of bamboo with sticks, and then a clave player, people having shakers, and then there were singers and dancers, and they're singing in Spanish with some references in Yoruba. And I was just really moved. It was just so deep. It was an otherworldly thing. And I would imagine it would be like if you were a kid playing skiffle and you saw you saw John Lee Hooker play all of a sudden, or you saw Little Walter play the harmonica, and you know, you were just like, what is that? You know, so, what is that? You know, and it really flipped me. And so that's in reference to percussion, that really pushed me into delving deeper into maybe folkloric music.
That was the seed for you then to inspire you to eventually make all the trips that you did to Cuba, right?
Yeah. Exactly. There was an organization called Caribbean Music and Dance with some really great. So again, you know, you find in life, sometimes you just fall into these, like, you just fall into this well of knowledge. So we go to Cuba. I didn't know, my Spanish sucked, you know, and I didn't know clave. I didn't know anything. All of a sudden, here I was for a week or two taking classes with guys like Roberto Vizcaino, who's probably one of the best conga players ever, Changuito, mm-hmm. you know, who had a hand in inventing songo, and guys like Carlos Aldama, who is one of the masters of bata, Jose Eladio, who is the director of the Escuela Nacional de Arte, who's one of the best educators I've ever heard. And when you get there, when I got there, I realized, like, oh, it's not the drum set, it's the bongo for son music, it's the conga for folkloric and music popular, and then maybe they'll play some timbales. there's the shekere, there's a whole other family of instruments. And so kind of made it, man, I always intended just to just keep it to the trap set, but I thought I better, I understand the basics. I'll just learn the basics. But to, I'm still learning the basics though on Afro-Cuban. That was the thing. It's just like, I'll just learn a little jazz. You know, it's a lifelong pursuit, you know. All these years later, I'm still learning things from all those basic hand percussion things, and I still do them.
Oh yeah, and approximately how many times have you been down there to actually study?
Oh gosh, probably at least 5 or 6 times. At one point, I stayed a couple of months.
Yeah, that started though when you were still at Berkeley. When you first did that, your first trip, or was it after you got out of Berkeley?
A little bit in Berkeley, and then afterwards. I got a master's of arts in teaching, and I was teaching high school lit. And then, you know, one of the reasons was that I had summers off and I would go to Cuba and study. Mm-hmm. And again, play in bands, indie bands. So you got a ska band, I'll play. You got an indie rock band, I'll play. You got a rock band, I'll play. And just to say yes to everything and to keep the lights on and to keep food in the refrigerator, you know.
When you finished at Berkeley, did you actually stay in Boston for a while, or did you, where did you move to if you didn't stay in Boston?
L.A., straight to L.A. Boston's cool, but specifically Massachusetts is, for academics, it's unprecedented. And for a lifestyle, there's a very strong flavor there that either resonates or it doesn't, you know. And for me, I did have aspirations to maybe tour, do a record or two or something. And I just felt that the pool was so small in Boston, and I missed California. So I went to Los Angeles.
Okay. And did you, when you got back here, were you doing both drum set work and hand percussion stuff? Or
absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. But again, it's a sense of community. There was a drummer who was alive, the great Long John Oliva, and mm-hmm. he was having some really great workshops, and we all had access to his knowledge and experience. And LA has its own pool of really cool percussionists, and it's always good to go to a workshop and learn things and grow, and I certainly took advantage of that. You know?
Right. What was the first, would you say, your breakout gig that kind of put you at a place where, you know, because I know that, I'm not sure exactly when Jack Johnson came into your life, but kind of give us a little timeline on what was kind of like your first, would you say your first, you know, recognizable thing after college?
Well, this was way after college and grad school, and I was working, you know, I was making the choice between, you know, being a career school teacher, you know, I was about to sign a contract for a public school that was actually, you know, I was living hand to mouth and, you know, but if I would have signed this contract, it would have been a very serious commitment just teaching. And I literally sat across the street thinking about whether or not I wanted to go in there and do that. And I you know, when you look at two paths, and I just thought, you know, at that point in my life, I didn't have much to lose. I just thought, no, I'm not going to do this. This is not my heart. I want to do music. You know, I want to do something else. I want to, you know, and so I passed on the contract. They were a little bummed, you know, and then shortly after that, I connected with a guitar player named Joey Santiago, who plays in a group called the Pixies.
Sure.
At the time, they were on hiatus, And he had a band called The Martinis with his then wife, Linda. Really, really great. And that was like, that was an incredible opportunity and an education that they gave me. And just being, playing out of town and being a drummer, like a rock drummer, you know, and being a part of a band and learning the ropes, the reality, you know, there's one real, you watch the Monkees, you know, on TV, and you know, oh, they're a band, they're, look at them, they're having fun and they're playing music. And you look up on stage, you see a bunch of musicians playing and you think, God, they're just having the time of their lives. And, you know, but then when you join a band and you get the reality, you really see it, you know. And it was just a really good education. It was a good opportunity.
Was Joey doing a solo thing and still doing the Pixies at the same time? Or
Pixies were on hiatus, and he was just, he had a band. So then my friend J.P. Plunier, who owns Everloving Records and who was managing Ben Harper, introduced me to Jack Johnson. And at the time, I had a little rehearsal studio at TK. Do you still have a room there?
I do.
Yeah, I had a room there. I think it was in the same building as yours. And Jack came by and had a beat up old car and a beat up old amp and a guitar his mom got me. And he just graduated from UCSB. And we went in my practice room and he just started playing me these songs. And that was like the first time I'd heard. I'd played with many singer-songwriters and good ones too. You know, you could sing and pitch. They can play guitar in a dark club and not look at the neck, and they can write songs. And but, you know, you play with someone else that has something so compelling. You're like, who the heck is this guy? You know, in a sense that those songs were so simple and so phenomenal. You know, I just couldn't believe it, you know. And on top of it, he just was such a solid person. And a different kind of guy, you know. We started just playing in my practice room and going through some songs that would later be the songs on a record called Brush Fire Fairy Tales.
Right.
And he had a buzz. And we went and I just remember doing a show with him at the Mint. And it was sold out. And Kelly Slater was there. Pam Anderson was there. And, you know, a bunch of iconic surfers were there. And it was a whole other scene, you know, than what I was used to. Music wasn't complex, but it was deep. And
he hadn't had a record out yet at that point, right?
No.
Okay.
No. We played some really good shows. We bonded. And then I didn't hear from him. He just went dead silent. And I guess what I didn't know is that there was a bidding war for him. You know, the word got out. People like David Foster, people like... you know, like labels like DreamWorks, and a lot of people were coming at him, and he really had some big choices to make. I can only imagine what it was like, you know, as a young person having all these fancy people come at you. And he's always been a grounded dude, and he decided he was so entrenched in like the, so if we reference the Ben Harper scene, Ben was out there really inspiring a lot of us. And my impression of Ben Harper is that he's cut from his own cloth, you know, from Claremont, Inland Empire. But I just saw him channeling later, like things like Bill Withers or things like John Lee Hooker, but also funk things and reggae things and African things. And it was the folk rock kind of vibe, this sort of soulful folk thing that Jack was really into, and lyrics that had substance and were introspective, and that there was some integrity behind it. And I think he chose to go with an indie label owned by my friend JP. And part of the attraction was that there was the connection with Ben. You know, Ben Harper played some Lap Steel on I think what the single, this song called Flake is, and Ben put Lap Steel on that, and we went on the road with Ben and opened for him quite a bit and learned the ropes even more. And there I played drum kit, but I also played some percussion. I have always had congas slung to the left of the drum set. And there were times when it was just, you just play percussion, you know? And so the stuff in Cuba that I thought I'd never be able to use suddenly were very useful, you know?
Right. And then was it pretty soon after that you guys did that first album?
We did that record in 3 days. The first day I had a telemarketing gig. First day I did it, we recorded it at the studio called Grandmaster, which is no longer. We did it on tape. We were all too nervous the first day, so they erased it. And then we tracked the record on a Saturday and Sunday. And then I went back to work on Monday.
Wow.
He did some overdubs, but the record was essentially tracked in a very short amount of time.
Right. And it's been how many years now? I mean, you've done, I don't know the number of records you've done with Jack, but...
yeah, it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I think.
Right. The thing about him, aside from being such a great singer-songwriter and have such a unique thing, such an organic thing, I've always been very impressed with his loyalty to the band and how he's had, you guys have been a part of his thing for so long, and that's very impressive to me, seeing how our industry can be. And it really gave you all in the band a chance to become a band and to contribute what you bring to the table and develop it throughout other records, which I think is really makes something very special. I've always often thought that about what you do with him.
And unprecedented. Unprecedented.
Yeah, it really is. It really, really is. And the percussion side of that, intermittently, you were still going to Cuba once in a while and studying.
Yes.
I think that what I wanted to talk about to do today is the fact that your deep knowledge of folkloric and what you've learned when you were down there goes so well with what we do at Gombops, and specifically the drums that you like to play, which is the Mariano series, which is kind of a return for us back to more of a traditional Cuban drum. And you've done a lot of recording with those, and I think that's something that it kind of, you know, is akin to that study that you did. You've also had a chance to use them live with Jack as well, and broken down pieces and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting for people to know that side of you that might think of you more of a drum set artist, that you might not know all of the different facets of what you do here in Los Angeles and the different bands that you've put together. I'm curious about that now, like the Culver City Dub Collective or some of the other original projects that you've had in town here have really steeped into that world, into that more folkloric world. Let's talk a little bit about how you started putting those kinds of ensembles together. I think that's really interesting and akin to what we do in percussion, you know?
Oh, cool. Well, you know, I did a record in 2004 called Ritmo y Canto.
Right.
And that was Afro-Cuban folkloric songs and stuff. And it was a really interesting group of drummers and singers too that got involved in that. This guy, Juan Calvo Flores, or they called him Juanito, who's, you know, there's so, and it's almost maybe akin to maybe blues or country or something and other folk styles, in that there's people that have hit the spotlights, and there are people that are virtuosos that only people really close to the genre know. And this guy Juanito, certainly when he played a quinto, when he played quinto, when he played güiro, when he would touch a drum, it was like nothing. It was sublime. But his main thing was dancing, no joke. So he performed on the recording. This woman, Teresita Dome Perez, her mom was in the Muñequitos, and she was a singer for Afro Cuba de Matanzas. She sang on the recording. But then I also involved a lot of my friends that I played rumba in the park with too. And so that was a nice experience, you know, for us to do yambu, wawanko, makuta, play some bata rhythms, you know, respectfully and humbly paying homage to the Orisha side of things. That was a nice opportunity, you know. Fast forwarding to maybe Culver City Dub Collective, which was like more like reggae, dub, electronica.
And who's in? Who was in the Dub Collective with you?
Well, my friend Fran Chotone and I were the main guys, but we had guest artists like we got Ben Harper involved and Jack Johnson, Tom Dumont from No Doubt. We got Leon Mobley, who's a really great percussionist.
Right.
This really great French singer named Don Cavalli, and another singer from Europe and France named Pierce Ficini. Really interesting artists who jumped in and played. Oh, and Rico Rodriguez from The Specials. Right. But I would sneak in Afro-Cuban type rhythms within there. You know, of course, respectfully, because it is a religious, sacred kind of thing. So I kind of would be very selective about what I put in there.
Sure.
But stuff that was acceptable that I could put into some of the non-religious stuff that I'd sneak in there, I would, because I think it gives it flavor. And that type of syncopation, someone may not know what it is, a non-drummer, but you can feel it, and it has an air about it. And I'm really glad I got to do it. So those were all mediums of expression that I couldn't necessarily do if I was working for an artist. But if it was my own thing, absolutely, That clave is going in there. That guiro is going in there. That shekere is going to go in there.
Yeah, of course.
The bongos are going to go in there,
And it's so fun to have that open door like that.
Yeah, and sometimes you have to, and I noticed this with you too, Rich, and a lot of other people. We talked earlier about the home recording thing. Sometimes we gotta make that door ourselves and build that door and open it ourselves. It's not readily there, And so, of course, I love a backbeat as much as anybody, but I don't always, I mostly get asked to do a backbeat, So for me to write my own material gave me the chance to do some of the stuff that I wanted to do, that I didn't necessarily get asked to do.
It's an interesting path from when you started listening, like we all did with bands like Kiss and classic rock bands to this, but it also is a testament to the whole picture,
Yep.
And the record Ritmo y Canto,
Ritmo y Canto.
Yeah, that record. I'm curious about that record. That was around 2003 or something when you did that record.
2003, 2004. Yeah.
Yeah, and how can people find that?
If you go on my website, if you go on Spotify, if you go on iTunes, if you just look it up, Ritmo y Canto, it's out there, man.
Okay, I'll play a little bit of that in a little bit. And then you have kind of delved into some other things in the past few years that I find really interesting too. You did a jazz record, which is beautiful, and actually had some nice chart activity, which congrats for that.
Thank you.
I mean, in today's age, it's really a great achievement to be able to have that, and nice to, be able to see that kind of return. But also you did singer-songwriter record too. And I think that's very interesting. The jazz record, I'm curious about that album, because I can, in listening to it, I hear your influences, your influences, and even I hear, Elvin and people like that in that record. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the jazz record, and what is the name of that one?
That one's called Blue Painted Walls and Faraway Places, and I think. There's a lot of the soul jazz records, There's backbeats and stuff. I wasn't necessarily, when you start going, spang-a-lang, ding-da-ding, ding-da-ding, and that's straight ahead jazz, and that's a that's a beautiful discipline, and one that I'd like to do more of. And I love jazz. I studied with Alan Dawson, and Elvin is a huge love for me. So is Billy Higgins and the great Ed Blackwell. But there's also soul jazz music, drummers like Idris Muhammad, stuff that you could kind of groove to.
Right.
And I think that I wanted to give it like a really beautiful sort of a West Coast, not in a weak sense. I hate to say weak. Sometimes when someone says West Coast jazz, it's going to have strings in it, or it's going to be really relaxed, I didn't mean like that, but I mean like something that you could play if you were traveling, or if you were on a boat, or with, something panoramic, I suppose,
right,
if you will, and something that had a feel to it. So, you know, there's a lot of, there's an artist named Mulatu, you know, Jazz Ethiopiques, you know, that were using a backbeat, but really interesting harmonies underneath it. So there's a jazz reference, but it's got a groove to it, you know, and so it was really fun delving into that, because that was a really nice adventure too, and I'm really proud of that. And it was fun. We're tracking it live, no clicks or anything like that, you know, getting good takes,
which is always so much fun. And that whole process of tracking live is you don't get to do it very often, really. I mean, it's really a great thing to be able to put people in the same room. I mean, these days, especially right now, I mean, it's going to be a while before we get to do that again. But And the singer-songwriter record, I think that this is another side of you that I think is really interesting and creative, and also bringing out some of your influences. I'm curious about some of the influences that you have from writing some of that stuff.
Yeah. Those songs, you know, the tricky thing, since this is a drumming and percussion podcast, you know, I bet a lot of you guys, you drummers out there, will relate that people love drumming. It's essential. But, you know, when somebody sings words or lyrics, it has this way of connecting to people in a big way, you know? And I always felt, well, I wrestled with it, you know, because it felt like if you work for all these artists, you know, and you're there supporting them, you want to embrace that support role 100%, you know? But I also felt to myself that, like, I think it's important for me to leave the drum seat. And I think it's important for me to explore singing a little bit too, and maybe writing some lyrics too, and constructing songs as well, you know? And that experience, I really enjoyed writing songs that I deeply connected with, you know, about maybe, you know, my own experiences, or, you know, maybe in a roundabout way, making a few points, not really directly, but, you know, being a fan of someone like Leonard Cohen or Bob Dylan or Lou Reed, you know, some of the greats, you know, Hank Williams Jr., if you will, or Bill Withers, or all these people, you know, you really connect with them as well. And a lot of the people that I mentioned didn't even strike me as great vocalists necessarily. You know, I like Johnny Cash a lot. He's, you know, I don't think those guys are vocalists. They're like storytellers. They sing. They certainly sing. Dylan sings and Lou Reed sings, but they're storytellers. And so I think putting some of my beats down and maybe telling some stories was just a further extension of musical composition, maybe in its most basic form. So singer-songwriter, that's always been a term that I'm not necessarily fully embraced, you know, because it's all just music, you know. Singer-songwriter to me can connotate something. It almost sometimes feels like a pejorative to me, mm-hmm. you know, a little bit, but it isn't, you know. I just think it's all music.
Right.
I do think it's all music. I think the drums have sometimes been maybe a little undermined, you know, within popular music, in terms of, like, you know, whether it's a beat that's really important, but from a commercial standpoint, from compensation point, it's very controversial what drummers have gone through.
Well, I mean,
and not getting any, you know, not sounding bitter at all. It's just the way it is.
Sure.
But versus a vocalist or somebody that writes a melody, how their contributions are weighted versus the drums.
But it's so true that we've seen that, especially with some of the contemporary music that we've heard the past 10 to 15 years, where, you know, it's gone more out of the box than actually acoustically live with the rhythm, or grabbing old grooves that we've all grown up on and just looping them and sampling stuff, you know, that whole thing that's kind of, in some respects been cool, but some respects taken the place of some of the organic stuff. I totally understand and agree with you on that. So getting back to that.
And again, I don't feel that that's been my experience with any of my friends. I'm very happy with everything, but I do think that, I kind of wanted to show myself and that I was a drummer by choice, not because I didn't have the intellect to write a song or sing or put together something introspective, you know? So I think that doing two records where I held myself to task to sing and to compose was really good for my musical growth, right. You know? And I'm really glad I did it.
Much lower can I go with a vacant stare and a smile and a $20 soul? So hollow, so low, so low, so low. You keep on giving, but I won't go. I keep on thinking that you're hollow like me when your heart's made of gold.
Adam, talk a little bit about your Gombops gear, and I'm just curious what you're using currently and how it's working with different styles, because you play so many different styles of music.
Thanks, Rich. I think the Mariano congas are kind of a piece of history. Didn't the original Mariano builder, actually the guy that developed the lugs with the wrench tightening, or I don't know.
Wow, that I don't know. I would like to know that, but I'm not sure.
I don't know. I'd heard something like that, but of course the Marianos have that really classic sound, and the microphones react to them in a certain way. A lot of air gets through them, you know, as opposed to maybe a fiberglass or a thicker one, but it just feels right. There's a nice vibe to them, and I use them live, and they're so well made. I had so much fun buying a bunch of different of the tambourines that you guys have with the claw hook. That's really awesome. All the jingles have different pitches on them, and they work differently within songs. I love that so much. The flamenco cajon is of course really great and super useful and comfortable, and I can connect with that. You guys carry stuff by Pete Englehart that has like a kind of a heco type of device, and that's really great for some musical effects, you know. The bells that you guys put out, specifically the Alex Acuña series, the cha-cha bell, and I think it's a bongo bell. I use those quite a bit, you know. And then in general, I just get on the website and it all just looks so great, you know. I kind of want to just get everything. I just have to kind of pick my battles, honestly. But of course, the thing that I use on every single percussion gig I have is the bucket shekere. That thing is incredible. I can't say enough about it. I mean, of course, I'm biased because Will's one of my best friends, Will Phillips, who helped design it. But it's so great. Oh, my God. So I use it. I don't use it like Will does. I put it on a snare stand. The top I'll use with the stick where or the bottom, I guess you call it, the where it sits up on, you can tap on it and make it sound like a cowbell. You can play cascada on the side. You can tap it and it's like a one hit shaker. It's just such a great device. Every gig I use it on, honestly, every gig I've used it on, it's been the mainstay. And quite often people come up and just say, dude, where is that? I want to get that, you know? So that's been a game changer for me. So those are some of the devices I love.
Before we wrap up, I just wanted to talk briefly about what's the latest thing that you have going. I think it has to do with Matt Costa and the project called Cuando, right? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, in 2019, I put out a record called Cuando on Everloving Records, and that was produced by Matt Costa, who's hands down one of my favorite singer-songwriters. I use that term. Mm-hmm. Artists, musicians around. And it was just, it's really sonically beautiful record. I'm just really happy it came out the way it did. And there I got to kind of delve a little bit more into, I don't know. It's so interesting doing a record where you hire instrumentalists to back you up is one thing. But if you have other songwriters playing instruments to back you up, it's a whole other experience, you know. Matt was able to help me get some sounds and some feelings with this music that I was after for the longest time but couldn't get, you know, where, you know, a guy like Matt really listens to a lot of old blues and British folk music, and he's a, you know, whether it's the Kinks, whether it's psychedelic stuff or whether it's really beautiful flamenco classical stuff. And we had a great time. And that record was not done in any fancy recording studios. We just sort of jumped from home rig to home rig. And I'm really proud of that.
Is it mainly a duo record, the two of you?
No. I mean, we did some duo performances here and there, but it's, you know, when you're recording in a studio, you know, you just overdub everything,
right?
You know? So, 90% of the string work he did. I played a little guitar, but
okay.
And then he did a little bit of backup vocals, and then so I did some just rhythm guitar and percussion and sang. And he really brought the best out of me. That was a gift.
Besamos, I feel so strange, like I never felt any kind of kiss before. Nos abrazamos, we dance so slow, but I never guessed we'd share this kind of love before. This empty night, this quiet room, these empty glasses, love too soon. Falling secrets on my sleeve, so deep I can't believe. This well is gone. You say we never should have loved like we did before. Conversamos with these awkward words, trying to show us all the clouds we didn't see.
Do you have anything coming up that you want to announce or what you're working on right now?
No, I mean, really, I'm just home playing, you know. Shows are very slow right now and performances are really slow. And so this has just been a time, like I've been doing things like there's a company called Breedlove Guitars, and I did like an online like live performance there. I'll like do like live recording and live performances at the house. I did one for 4th of July with some really great musicians to honor the veterans. And you know, right. On that presentation, there were other great artists like Ben Harper jumped on and played an acoustic set, you know, in between what we did. I'm going to be doing another podcast. I think I'm scheduled with another great interviewer as well. So things like that. And then I'm just continuing to play and to grow as a musician and percussionist. And I can't wait for things to start back up so I can get out there and play.
No kidding. And people can find you if they want to find you. What's the best way?
Well, you can get a hold of me, adamtopel.com. There's a contact form there, or, you know, social media. I occasionally look at my Facebook or Instagram, so you could probably get me there. If you jump on adamtopel.com, it's got like samples of what I do, you know, musically. And, you know, feel free to check out the Everloving Records site that they have as well. You can check out what I do as well as some of their other amazing artists, and Brushfire Records as well. Same thing.
Great. Adam, thank you for being a part of this.
Oh, it's an honor.
So great to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, man, you too.
And great to have you as part of our Gone Bops family.
It's an honor.
For so long.
Awesome.
And we really appreciate the support. And everybody, stay tuned to all of our social media and our website for future show announcements that are coming up, future podcast episodes. And we're looking forward to bringing more of your favorite Gone Bops artists and educators very soon. So stay tuned. And Adam, thank you again.
Thanks, Rich.